Good morning. First of all, thank you very much for choosing our session this morning. The Seven Deadly Sins of Fundamental Global Investment or Management, catchy title, I'm sure you'll agree. But hopefully you'll find it interesting and hopefully thought-provoking as well. Now, Aberdeen, we're strong believers that fundamentals drive long-term company or stock performance. And certainly only yesterday we heard from Philippa and Ruth about some of the challenges facing the global economy. And Philippa herself said that companies who are going to prosper in this environment are those with strong fundamentals. In her case, she mentioned strong cash flow and companies who can actually pass on margin increases as well. So we are strong believers that these are very much stock pickers markets. Now, as international managers, we have a very unique opportunity set. As international managers, we can invest in any company anywhere in the world, or equally importantly, not invest in that company. Now, from our point of view, too many managers impose artificial constraints on their portfolios. Some of them diversify away their skill, some of them overtrade away their skill. And at the end of the day, what we're really looking at is to add value for our clients, whereas too many managers are actually trying to minimize their risk of underperforming the benchmark rather than trying to maximize their clients' returns. So we've got these closet benchmark huggers who are managing their risk and are charging you active fees for index returns. And today, Bruce is going to identify some of these seven deadly sins, the telltale signs, and what you should really be looking for in a truly active manager. Bruce has actually been with Aberdeen for over 20 years, has vast amount of experience in international markets. And without further ado, I'll hand over to Bruce, who will take you through the presentation. Thank you.
There's your thing. Thanks very much, Stuart. Maybe that sounds a bit loud, is it? Is that okay? Yeah. The seven deadly sins of fundamental global equity. According to the Christian teachings and the Roman Catholic Church, everybody in this room is a sinner to different degrees. And just looking at you all, I can see why that's true. There's two types of sin, according to the church. There is venial sin, which is relatively unimportant ones, and there are mortal sins. These are the worst ones. These are the ones you get sent to the dark place for. I'm not ecclesiastically qualified, actually, to hear your confessions today about the sins that you have or haven't done. But I may be able to identify some of the portfolio manager sins that we fall into from time to time. I come from a country and a place in the north of Scotland where economic sin is taught to you at a very early age. I remember when I was young, going to my dad and saying, is it a sin to spend your pocket money on a Sunday? And he said, it's a sin to spend your pocket money any day. I remember coming in from school once and I was all excited. I'd run home behind the bus the whole way and I said to my mum, look, mum, I've run behind the bus and I've saved 20p. And she bashed me across the back of the head. She said, next time run behind a taxi and save a couple of quid. Now, that's the kind of mentality that you're talking about in investment. You're always looking to save a couple of quid because you don't want to lose some money. So rather than just go through a staid synopsis of global investment, we thought we'd put this seven deadly sins quirk on it and take it through from a financial perspective. The first sin is lust. What a terrific sin to start with. Unfortunately, from a financial perspective, this is the most boring of all the sins because this is the sin that looks at risk. The market's obsessive tendency to want to quantify risk in some kind of scientific formula. How boring would that be if we could do it? There would be no human input whatsoever. But a whole industry has been spawned over the years to try and do just that. In the various models that you see here, there have been numerous PhDs and academics who have run many models to find out if you can actually measure risk in a quantifiable amount. risk being the standard deviation of an asset in terms of its volatility over time of that asset, and that is meant to be a qualification of risk. The more volatile the asset, the more risky it is. Well, it's an unusual way to look at things, actually, because humans are involved, and when humans are involved, there are always unrealistic assumptions that come into the equation. If you consider an asset a stock, two people may own that stock at the same time. One might be Warren Buffett, one might be a day trader. One holds it because they want to make steady returns over 20 years. The other one holds it because they want to make half a point by lunchtime. Do they both perceive that asset in the same risk way? It's very subjective indeed. And models that you put together on risk significantly underestimate tail risk. And tail risk are the bit of the edges of a normal distribution that you cannot predict when they come along. The event risk, if you like, that happens to come by. The solution, as far as we're concerned, is to take a more qualitative approach to risk. And we'll develop that in a minute. But basically, it means applying common sense when you're looking at companies and stocks and valuations in your quantification of risk and diversifying your portfolio in order to control it. Because at the end of the day, absolute risk is buying a poor quality company at the wrong price because you'll lose your money. The second of the sins we've identified is gluttony. This is the sin of trading means active management. The more the trade, the more active you are. Well, this is an interesting one as well, because holding periods are getting shorter all the time. In the 1950s, the average holding period of a stock was 7 to 8 years. Last year, the average holding period of a stock was 11 months. In 11 months, you have no fundamental improvement in a stock. It is all down to market sentiment and price changes. But yet studies have shown for years that turnover reduces risk, and we'll have a look at that in a moment. When I was reading into this presentation, looking at the models of black swans and white swans and all the rest of it, it kind of conjures up the image of another way of looking at a swan when it comes to trading, and that is of an upside down swan in the pond. It reminds me of many mutual funds out there. Its feet are going like crazy, and it's going nowhere. In fact, it's probably drowning. So the more turnover, the more activity doesn't necessarily mean the more performance you're going to get. To really get performance, you need to extend your time horizons. This is just a graph of turnover on performance from a study that shows less than 20% turnover, much higher returns, over 100% turnover, much lower returns. Really what you'd expect to see, and the numbers are in your presentation if you want to go into it deeper. This is a similar study that's in there. In the interest of time, I'll not explain all of it, but again, it shows that the input of excessive turnover reducing returns. Now, sorry, I don't have time to go right into these things, but we do only have 30 minutes, so I'll need to push on. But the solution, as far as we're concerned, to reduce trading, reduce costing your clients money, and also enhance performance, is to extend your time horizons. Everybody talks about the long term. Very few people actually practice it. Many people who practice it are called to account by clients after only 3 months or 6 months why you're underperforming, when in fact you've been hired for a 3 to 5 year time frame. Sometimes it's quite baffling. The third of the seven deadly sins is greed. Greed, that the more diversification you have in the portfolio, then the lower the risk. And of course, this is not true. What is the point in having hundreds of stocks in the portfolio if you know nothing about them whatsoever? They might all go down. It is one of the great fallacies of portfolio construction that you can add and add to stock numbers and you'll reduce your risk. You don't if you have no information on these stocks and you've no idea what they do. The solution, and this is again a study that shows diversification is one thing, but once you start to get correlation between the assets and the diversification, then the risk actually rises. Sure, it's good to diversify, but you have to be aware of what you're diversifying into. Again, it comes down to looking at solid company fundamentals rather than any collective asset allocation. The solution for this, as far as we are concerned, is conviction and concentration. In an ideal world, the perfect fund manager would have so much knowledge that the universe is almost infinite. But in reality, the perfect fund manager is the fund manager who can admit the limitations of what they know or don't know, cut out what they don't know, and concentrate on what they do know, what they're good at. And we all do not have the capacity to know everything, therefore we must focus on what we do know when we put a portfolio together. So it's conviction and concentration. Sloth is the fourth deadly sin. And at the risk of upsetting people, there is a tendency that people are lazy. They don't like to necessarily get out there and do the hard work. But if you really want to reduce your risk in a portfolio, you've got to get out there and know the companies. Go and visit the management. Look them in the eye. Find out if you can trust them. Find out if there's a good business there. And in a way, this is not a technical thing. This is called common sense. What's the point in trying to invest in a business you don't understand? If you don't understand it, you can't value it. If the company doesn't have a clear growth strategy, doesn't have some innovation or something better than its competitors, then it doesn't have a long-term future. Similarly, there's plenty of information from annual reports, from other pieces of research you can do to find out if the management is successful in doing what it says it does, if it's done it consistently for a long period of time. Do they look after shareholders or do they look after themselves? This is all hard work. It involves going out and visiting every company that you own and having conviction in that. To have that, you must have local presence and local knowledge. And you cannot underestimate local knowledge when it comes to a global perspective. I remember some time ago in Latin America when I was there, and there was a guy came to a function one night, and it was his first visit to the continent. He'd never been to Latin America before. He had a few beers that night and was getting a bit loud. And as the music started, he turned to the person on his right and he said, "Beautiful woman in red, would you like to waltz?" And the person turned round to him and said, "First of all, I don't dance. Secondly, that's not a waltz, that's the Venezuelan national anthem. And thirdly, I'm not a woman in red, I'm the Archbishop of Caracas." It helps to have some local knowledge. The fifth deadly sin is wrath. And wrath is volatility. Nobody likes volatility. But volatility is your friend. Without volatility, you cannot outperform. If we lived in a world of perfect knowledge with no volatility, then it'd be like living on Vulcan. As Mr. Spock says, like yesterday and the day before, today's earnings results are in line with expectations. Not surprising, really, because we know everything about the future and everything will behave rationally. So we need volatility to outperform. This, again, reflects the tail we talked about earlier when looking at risk. We cannot estimate the tail, and the tail will always come back to bite you every single time. There's no point of Goldman Sachs earlier this year suggesting that the credit crunch and its fallout was a 25 standard deviation event. Statistically, that is absolutely correct. What it means is the event of that credit crunch will happen once every trillion years. So none of us in this room have to worry about this event ever again, because we're not going to be here for it. But in the interim, it could still absolutely destroy you as a portfolio manager. So there's no point in putting labels on events. What we have to do is look at the volatility as our friend in the short term. Use it to buy companies and exploit opportunities as and when they arise for the longer term. But you must take a longer term future. Be patient. Expect periods of underperformance because it will happen. But very often when an event comes along, it doesn't change the underlying prospects for the company at all. It's noise, market noise. And that gives you the confidence to stand out and continue to buy it. Contrarianism and standing out from the crowd is again something in fund management that everybody talks about, but it's actually not that easy to practice. Because everybody likes to be the same because they feel comfortable. They don't like to be way out on the far side. My granny would have been a great fund manager. She wasn't, but she would have been a great fund manager. Because when my cousin, her grandson, Jock, when he qualified in the army and was at his passing out parade, hundreds of soldiers came marching down the road, and she was very proud. And she stood up as Jock was slightly at a different pace to everybody else and said, "Look, everybody's out of step apart from our Jock." That's the way you have to think sometimes as a fund manager, that everybody's out of step apart from you. Doesn't feel good, but sometimes, more than often, it pays very much to do so. The penultimate seven sin is envy, the benchmark returns. Everybody uses this. The industry is judged by it. But the great fallacy is to believe that the benchmark represents a zero-risk position at the beginning. If you have two funds, one of which is benchmarked to the MSCI World today and one of which is diversified across the world, the benchmark position will start with 44% of its assets in the United States. That is not a low-risk starting point. That is a quasi-American fund. A non-benchmark fund with a scattering of assets in 25 different countries is much lower risk, providing you know about these companies, than the benchmark. So we mustn't make the mistake to think that the benchmark is a starting point. I've heard it said before that benchmark investing is like riding on a Vespa scooter with all the mirrors looking backwards. That's what you're doing. All your benchmark will ever tell you is what happened before, not what's going to happen in the future. So the starting point, forget it. Look at the companies. This, again, is in your pamphlets, and it really goes to explain this. It's trying to explain how much you actually pay for active fund management. When this study was done, it looked at global portfolios where they took out the bit that was actually benchmark stocks or closet benchmarking and applied the fee structure to what was judged to be the active component of the fund. And they saw that you were paying 5 or 7% for that active bit. The rest was benchmark. If you want a benchmark fund, buy one, but don't pay through the nose for it because it's a simple thing to run and you shouldn't be paying anything like that for fees. So beware of active managers masquerading as active managers when in fact they're closet benchmarkers. The solution is to avoid it. Go with people who have conviction, concentration in their portfolios, and you'll be much better off in the long term. And finally, pride. Pride is a funny sin. In as much as we all think we're better at things than we actually are. The industry is full of people who've had three good years on the bounce and they think they're an oracle on the subject, when in fact they're not. And overconfidence can help us in various aspects of life, but it certainly doesn't help you in fund management. We in Scotland like to pride ourselves on our inferiority complexes and our persecution complexes that make sure that we never get too overconfident. There's a couple of tests here. One of which I hope you will try and go and ask Stuart about later, because it's completely baffling to me. The first one really just exemplifies the fact that when you ask people on average three quick questions, and people who are very confident and impulsive do much worse than people who are more logical and thorough. Unfortunately, the logical and thorough people, according to this study, are more fund managers. Well, that may well be the case, but it still doesn't happen to help them outperform when still 70% of active fund managers don't outperform. The explanation to this is in the GOAT probability theory, which to me is totally baffling, but I'm sure Stuart will explain it to you. The fact that there's three doors here and you're offered one choice. There's a car behind one door and two goats behind the other. Before you press the button and make your choice, one door is opened and a goat comes up. Do you or do you not, or have you not, increased your probability of making the right answer now that you're down to two doors? Well, the answer is you haven't, but the explanation is long and complex. The implications are that you have to be aware of your limitations as a fund manager, as investment, like any other walk of life, and don't get carried away just because you happen to have some successes. Just to sum up, the seven deadly sins and the last things is a picture, actually, that was painted by a guy called Bosch in 1485, and it depicts the seven deadly sins and four rings round about it. The rings represent judgment, hell, death, and glory. And these are interesting applications to the investment management and portfolio construction, because in judgment, we will all be judged. We get judged all the time. But if you're going to be judged, then make sure you're judged for something you actively do, that you actively take positions, that you actively back your judgment and go for larger holdings, that you don't quasi-benchmark. If you're going to hell, and hell in this case is the tyranny of the benchmark, then make sure you're not overpaying for it. There's plenty of people, as I say, out there who'll take your money off you for benchmark, for active fund management, when in fact they're quasi-benchmarking. So always be aware of that. And death in this business is to not do these things, to not stand out from the crowd, to just go along with what feels comfortable. There's a story about an oil prospector who dies and goes up to heaven, and St. Peter's at the gates, and he's asked if he'd come in. He said, you've had a good life. You've not done anything wrong, but he said, I've got a whole shed full of oil prospectors here trying to get into heaven, and there's no room for you, so I'm sorry. He said to St. Peter, could I just go and say four words to the people in the shed? And he said, yeah, that's fine. So he goes up to them, cups his hand and says, oil discovered in hell. And just like that, the shed's empty. With their wings, they fly down to hell in search of oil. St. Peter says to the oil prospector, that was a good trick. I've never seen that before. Well done. He said, the shed's empty. There to wait. You'll be into heaven very shortly. And the oil prospector looks at him and said, well, thanks very much, he said, but I've changed my mind. He said, there might actually be some truth in that rumour. And as for glory, well, glory, as I say, is something that people like to bask in on an individual basis. And in this business, there is nothing worse than somebody who's got a couple of good years of performance and think that they're the oracle. With that breeds arrogance. With arrogance breeds contempt and non-professionalism. We think it's much better to go with a team of people, share it amongst individuals. Nobody is indispensable. The process is much more important than a personality. And that would be our suggestion for looking at how portfolios are constructed and how international equities should be managed. Thanks very much.
Some of you some food for thought. Perhaps some of you now want to go back and talk to your international equity managers and challenge them, ask them how are they actually managing their portfolios. Now we do have time for some questions, and we've also got John here from Van Eyck. So we're looking to have him in the room as well to make some comments, and also, I don't know if you had any questions you wanted to ask, John?
Yeah, Bruce, thanks for articulating some of the pitfalls of investing in the portfolio construction. I'm just wondering, in your article, you talk about some of the pitfalls of looking at valuation of companies.
Yeah.
Obviously, a lot of the issue you address is very important. Sorry.
You talk about a lot of the pitfalls of the conventional use of valuation model in looking at companies' value. What approach would you take to looking at the value of a company?
Okay. It comes back to the business, if you like. One of the most dangerous pitfalls in investment management that's not in the seven sins, but most certainly is out there, is the value trap. The company that you look at and you think there's intrinsic value in this thing, it must come through at some point. It's come down such a long way. But at the end of the day, you have to forget about the past and look at the future. If you look at GM today, this is a company that we at Aberdeen would never buy GM. So if GM doubles, triples, quadruples, then that's fine. Somebody else will make some money. But we'll never own it. For the simple reason, it doesn't matter what the valuation of the company is. When you go and see them, this is a company that's one of the biggest car manufacturers in the world. It doesn't make any money out of cars. It makes all its money out of financial services. And if you want to own a financial services company, go and buy a bank. Don't buy a car manufacturer with a loss leader. So it comes back to understanding the business. And if you understand the business and where it gets its money from, then you can start to look at the valuation. And what we don't do is be a slave to any one valuation parameter. Because when you're looking at companies from a global perspective, there can be every good reason why a utility in an emerging market is worth a lot more than a utility in a developed market. Because a utility in a developed market may be a very mature, regulated business that's past its peak, whereas a utility in an emerging market might be an extremely dynamic growth business with all the growth in front of it. So really it comes down to a company-by-company specific analysis of where the business is going and what price you estimate you should pay for that growth. Does that answer your question?
Thanks.
For the back. Bruce, thank you for your talk. It's not every day that you come across a manager that sticks a label on it, say I'm a high conviction manager. I have a question that I'd really respect to how you actually have managed the portfolio in the last 12 months, whether there were any structural changes you made to the portfolio to deal with the event risk that we have.
Well, the process that we deploy is one that we are not smart enough to predict tail events in the future. We're not smart enough to predict the top or bottom in stocks. What we do in many ways is very, very boring. What we do is buy more of things that we've got a lot of confidence in that are going down, especially if they're going down due to exogenous factors elsewhere. And we will finance that from things in the portfolio that continue to do very, very well. It's a gradual process. You never get the bottom in stocks and you never get the top. But by deploying one whereby you just chip away, then you can add on a monthly basis, hopefully, to returns. So in the past 12 months, whilst the case cannot be made, as far as we're concerned, for US or UK financials, which look absolutely appalling in terms of the fundamentals of the business and the wreckage that's like to be left when it's over, that same can't be said for European financials. And European financials have come down in sympathy, but many of them have very strong balance sheets and are in a real strong position to take advantage of other financial problems going forward. So we've been adding to European financials in the last 6 months in things like Zurich Financial, MAPFRE, Nordea, Commerzbank, Deutsche Postbank. We have no idea if these equity prices have stopped falling. And we're not interested in any positive contribution necessarily from those stocks this year or next year. We have no idea. What we do know, on a 3 to 5 year view, they look really good value at the moment with good growth prospects. So we will continue to follow that strategy.
Can I take it to mean you would sell and put stock in the portfolio and outperform or buy something?
Of course we do, but what we don't do is we don't sell right out of a good stock in the portfolio. What happens with good stocks in the portfolio is they become 3.5%, 4%, 4.5% positions. So you just take 0.5% out to refinance the existing position or a new position that you like. Every time you change a stock and come right out of it and want to go right back into it, it's an extremely difficult thing to do. If you have a good company, a good business with very good prospects, why would you want to sell it? One thing's for sure, at any particular period in the market, that stock will look either expensive and rich on a historical basis, or cheaper on a historical basis. But unless you're totally confident that you can get out and get back in, i.e. the high trading argument, then it's a very dangerous thing to do. So when we look at our portfolios and see things like Petrobras and Zurich Financial and Commerzbank, they've been in there for years and years and years. And over the longer term, you ride out the short-term volatility, perhaps adding a small bit on weakness and taking out a small bit on strength, but not completely coming out. And it's the longer term that really delivers the superior returns.
So, Bruce, you mentioned the average holding period has come down significantly. Obviously, the day trade phenomenon affects that. But do you think the quarterly reporting regime that we now have has contributed to that as well?
Quarterly reporting doesn't help. But one of the other things in the industry that has been tested many, many times is that many fund managers suffer from myopic loss aversion. So when companies rise, they don't bother about it. But when companies fall, they become very concentrated on it and will often sell out immediately of something that breaks perhaps a 10% down price limit. It increases trading, but it's not, rather than standing back and saying, is a good business, should we buy more, it breaks a support level in price and they sell it. That is trading a stock as opposed to understanding a business. It may work for some people in the very short term, but it's an extremely difficult thing to do. There is a proliferation of that type of behavior in the market, increasingly because technology allows it. Technology allows you to be a day trader from your front room if you want. And there are a lot of people do it. But that, as far as we're concerned, is not investment management. That is speculation, gambling.
Any more questions?
So when I was a young chap, I used to think that fund managers were sort of people like you, really, who were sort of Scottish, mean, you know, been around the block a few times, they knew what they were doing, they'd lived through a few crashes, they've made fundamental decisions. They help. I mean, you epitomised to me what a fund manager was always in my mind when I was young. But these days, it seems that they're all very young, and they haven't lived through all these turbulent times that we're talking about. Do you have lots of young managers in your office, and how do you control them?
See, this is a classic example of how appearances can be so deceptive. Just because you've got a few marks on your face and you're not perfect. I'm only 34. Some people say that experience is a hindrance. You need youth. Some people say experience is great. Youth is too impetuous. Neither one's correct. Of course, it's a balance. It's a balance of the type of person that's involved. In my own particular experience in fund management, I've always worked in a team. when there's no stars, when everybody has contributed, and it's the job of older people in the business to pass on their experience and their knowledge of what's happened to the next generation. But the only thing you can really say with certainty is that the only thing we learn from history is that we never learn from history. That is why we are having another banking crisis, the third of my short lifespan, because the lemming behaviour comes out every 10 years, and banks, every 10 years, invent a new way of losing people money. And it happens with monotonous regularity. So it's a mixture. You can have a lot of experience in the business or be young. What we do is try and get a mix at all times between youth and experience, because that prompts debate and it prompts you to be more broad thinking and look at things from all different angles. So we have a good mix, age and experience, men and women. They come at things from different angles, and it's very important, none more so than in investment management. Sorry, I just missed the last bit. You said, is it fair to say...
Assuming that you're fully invested, you run a high conviction.
We're fully invested at all time, of course.
Okay. Yeah. You run a high conviction account.
Yes.
You don't sell them in total position. You've done your homework.
Yes.
And I assume that you don't add too many new stocks to your portfolio.
No, I mean, typically, in a typical year over the last few years, the turnover's been less than 20%. The turnover has increased in the last 6 to 9 months, because there have been opportunities in the market in the last 6 months that we've been waiting for a long time. We know the companies we want to own, but they've always looked too expensive or it's not been the right time to buy. But in the last 3 months, or the last 6 months, we've added 3 new names, such as QBE in Australia, such as Procter & Gamble in the US, such as Takeda in Japan, because those companies got to valuations we've not seen for a long time, and were caught up in the general malaise of markets. They were all introduced at 1% positions. They're not exactly huge, although in the case of QBE, we got the opportunity to add another half. And we'll continue to build it up as if and when the stock continues to go down. If it doesn't go down, then we'll just hold on. So we're not slaves to turnover, and we admit that in certain periods, volatility must be embraced when it happens, because volatility, as we saw here, provide you with opportunities. There are many periods in the market sometimes for years, such as 2006 and 2007, when volatility practically disappears from stock markets and you don't get the same type of opportunities coming along. The important thing is to embrace them when they do come along and have the courage and conviction of your investment thinking to do that, not just talk about it. No, we don't. We're always fully invested, because we have to be always cognizant of the fact that we are part of our client. We are answerable to our clients, and our clients use us maybe part of an overall strategy. So if the client has a bearish view, the client may be sitting on big cash already and doesn't want that added to in their global equity bit. I mean, we could be part of a big, wide structure of small cap, global equities, maybe country funds, whatever. We don't know what they've got. They hire us to be fully invested at all time. And if they want to make an asset allocation call because they think markets are going down for 3 or 4 years, then presumably they would sell out or raise cash from somewhere else, or even us if they were that way inclined. But that's their call, that's not our call. No, never, no. No short selling and no stock lending.
What's your proxy cash holdings then for redemption?
We don't have proxy cash holdings. Every company that we own in the portfolio is in there on its own merit. In the retail format, in the event of redemptions, then that would be considered at the time what would be most appropriate to raise some cash from, so as not to distort the overall balance of the fund. But thankfully, in the last 5 years, we've not actually faced that as an issue at the moment. You know, it may happen in the future.
Yes, on average, the portfolios probably have about 1% to 2% on them on any given day, and that's obviously due to dividends being received, applications. So unless you have a very large redemption, we are funding it out of cash. We don't actually have to go and trade, but we don't, as Bruce says, specifically keep cash back for that purpose. But there's always a slush fund of cash moving in and out of the portfolio anyway. Well, I've got Bruce here. Does anybody else have any other questions, either on his presentation or equally on the markets?
I don't know. Is that in terms of the fund, the retail fund?
So, like, at a particular point in time, you're holding certain stocks that you have a value, you've got a value in your mind, it's what you're buying now.
Yeah.
Have you measured what that overall discount is?
No, we don't. And the reason that we don't do that is that we don't ever worry about the upside. You never have to worry about the upside. The upside will always take care of itself. Because if you buy a very good business that delivers earnings and dividends, it could theoretically go through multiple contraction until it went to zero. But normally what happens, at some point the market will recognise that this thing continues to deliver. When stock prices go up and up, we don't sell them, because often the company is actually getting cheaper and cheaper because the earnings and dividends might be going up faster than the price is going up. So in the case of something like Petrobras, which we've held for 10 years or so, but in the last 5 years, the company is much cheaper today than it was 5 years ago, even though the share price is up fivefold. And it's much cheaper today than it was 5 years ago because it's got much more cash flow. It's cheaper on a PE basis. It's cheaper on a cash flow basis. It's growing its dividend. And, you know, in the meantime, it's found the Tupi field in 25 years of proven oil reserves. So there's all sorts of factors coming in. But it's in a much stronger and better position today than it was 5 years ago. So despite the fact it's up fivefold in share price terms, the stock is actually cheaper, the company is actually cheaper and better positioned. So that's what we focus on rather than the price per se.
Okay, anyone else? Okay, in that case, if you'd like to join me in thanking Bruce for his time today and for his presentation, thank you. Thank you. Just in terms of wrapping things up from Aberdeen, obviously you can probably guess we try and avoid these seven deadly sins when we're putting together our portfolio. Basically what we're trying to do is find the best quality companies anywhere in the world, regardless of their location. As I say, we have this unique opportunity set. We really can invest anywhere, and we do try and fully embrace that. What we're looking for is good quality companies, companies with good, solid fundamentals, and then we want to invest in them at Scottish prices, i.e. cheaply. Ultimately, we ignore the benchmark. As Bruce pointed out, the benchmark is backwards looking. It tells us nothing about where the growth is going to be in the future. Too many managers say they don't like the US, we're underweight. So what do? They hold 42%. If you look at the fact sheets on your chairs, you'll see that we're actually around about 25% underweight the US. Not because we made a macro call, but either we can't find the right quality companies, or more likely in the case of the US, valuations or growth prospects aren't as attractive as elsewhere. The other thing is, once having bought these companies, as Bruce has alluded, we're long-term holders. Average turnover in the portfolio is about 20%. So very low turnover. Number of stocks in the portfolio, around about 50. Very high conviction. Your 100th best idea, or your 100th stock idea, is not your best idea. Why would you want to have 1% in 100 stocks? You know, it's this whole theory of taking many small bets without information. So if we like a company, we'll put a meaningful weight into it. We'll back ourselves. Equally, if we don't like a company, we'll have zero weight in it, so there's no fillers in the portfolio. So this is the type of manager you're looking for: high conviction, benchmark unaware, long-term track record, 84 fund managers around the world. We did 3,500 company visits last year. Then hopefully the fund's worth having a look at, and certainly you do have some of the stats there on your chairs. And perhaps Bruce won't thank me for this, because we don't sell on performance, you are buying a philosophy. One thing we can guarantee is we will underperform. We can't be all things to all markets. We have to be disciplined. And again, that's important. We don't chase markets. But having said that, from a sales point of view, we do have fantastic performance, enough to make our competitors cry. So if you want to have a look at the performance, and you've got some Mercer sheets there as well, not only have we got good performance versus the benchmark, but probably most importantly, it's been very consistent. So it's not, we've had a good year. You'll see there we've actually had very good long-term performance. And certainly I'd encourage you to come and chat to either myself to find about the goats, although I'm not sure if I know the answer to the goat story either. Or indeed, we've got Sumi here at the back. Some of you might know she's our BDM in Victoria. And we've got Con down here at the front, who's our BDM in New South Wales. So please feel free to come and have a chat. And Bruce will be here for the rest of the day as well. So we look forward to that. And thank you very much for your time.
Thanks. Thank you, Stuart. And I just wanted to finish by saying that we were in China early this year. I was leading a BRIC study tour to China in February. I don't think there's anyone in the room who was there, but we went to visit Bao Steel in Shanghai, and we were hosted actually by Aberdeen, and we went to see basically the largest steel producer in China at their factory, which is about an hour's drive out of Shanghai. And, you know, to me, as a, you know, long-term bull of China and the BRIC economies generally, I couldn't understand why Aberdeen were not jumping into this stock. They created a fantastic sort of investor briefing for us. The fundamentals of the company were obviously very, very strong. The woman who gave us the investor briefing spoke perfect English, presented a fantastic case to invest in Bao Steel. And I couldn't really understand why Aberdeen were holding back, because they'd made a number of visits and for whatever reason had decided not to invest. And this was just another opportunity for them to look at the stock again. And I had a long discussion with the local Aberdeen guys who were basically making that call, and they said, we love the stock, we love the fundamentals, we think it's a great company, we love the China story, everything about this stock is a buy, except we don't like the price. This is in February this year. Now, I don't know what the price of Bao Steel is today, but I expect it's 15% lower or more, and you probably still aren't in the stock. And, you know, to me, everything that Doug has said today underlines and highlights that particular decision. And and I'm sure Doug was the one saying, you know, don't do it, guys. I think it's Aberdeen, you know, to me, epitomised everything around fundamental, you know, good value investing. And I'm sure all of you will agree that having you here has been fantastic. Thanks for making the effort, and thanks for coming, both of you. Thanks. Thank you. Now, I have a 100% track record in this room in terms of the best of, so I hope you'll give us a great wrap in terms of your voting. So please get out your gizmo. Please take out your card from your lanyard, which I know you're all now good at doing. And before I forget, please leave your gizmo behind when you leave. Please don't take it with you. But perhaps we could now vote on this session. Is everyone ready to do that? Yep, so please go ahead now. Everyone done? Good. Okay, well, the next session starts in about 10 to 15 minutes. Those of you who are in the Marvin and Palmer session, it's in this room. So we'll start in about 10 to 15 minutes' time. Those of you who are moving to a different room, please go and find your way now. Thanks for coming.
All right.
So, I mean, so you're still not in Bastille?